is, from the forcible and bloody arrival of the Normans in 1066 to the French Huguenots in the 16th century through to the Jewish immigrants of the late 19th century. But over the last decade, the scale of immigration into Britain has increased markedly, almost trebling in 10 years, with a net inflow every year now of around 200,000 immigrants, or, translated another way, two cities the size of Exeter every year. This week, Britain's immigration minister Liam Byrne warned that such numbers had, in his words, deeply unsettled the country. He also bluntly chided those who sought to stifle debate over immigration, saying it was not racist to debate immigration. Mr. Byrne's argument was that significant inflows of population placed a strain on schools, hospitals, and the availability of housing, and that this tended to affect the poorest in society most, because they often lived in the areas settled in by immigrants, all of which fueled resentment and undermined community cohesion. It's an argument which has often been heard from those on the political right, but rarely from the left. And it's coincided with new controls on immigration unveiled by the government, which will introduce a point system whereby priority will be given to skilled and educated immigrants. Coincidentally, this week also saw the publication of a pamphlet by the think tank Civitas warning that Britain's sense of nationhood risked being undermined by the scale of immigration. So I brought together the report's author, David Conway, with Keith Best, a former Conservative MP and now Director of the Immigration Advisory Service, to consider the mounting political debate over immigration. First, I asked David Conway why he believed the scale of immigration could now undermine Britain's sense of nationhood.
It's a combination of the less than replacement level in terms of reproduction of the indigenous population combined with very high rates of fertility among recent immigrants, which is going to bring about a big demographic shift in terms of the ethnic and religious kind of identity of large areas of the population, many of whom have chosen to remain segregated in kind of enclaves. So what we're having is a breaking up of the unity that was once there and getting a plethora of different kind of subgroups.
But is this anything new? Because surely we have always had significant inflows of immigrants.
Of course, there has been continuous inflows of people, but it's in very, very, very small numbers.
So your argument essentially is it's the scale of immigration.
It's the recent scale, particularly since 1997.
Keith, do you accept there is an issue here?
I don't accept David's point that people have chosen to live in enclaves, to quote his words. I think many of those people find themselves very hard to come out of particular areas of poverty and deprivation. That was a point that Liam Byrne, the immigration minister, was making. But the fact remains that we've got 2,000 Britons every week leaving this country permanently to emigrate overseas. So Britain is a country which is experiencing both immigration and emigration.
But the figures surely show quite clearly that net immigration has increased significantly over the last 10 years. I think the latest figures for this year or last year show a net immigration of 200,000 people, well, which is much more than in previous generations.
I will accept the broad premise that we are now seeing net immigration, yes. I think you have to be very careful about the figures. Remember, most of those figures come from the
Those are government figures.
They come from the Office of National Statistics, yeah. And in fairness to the government, they are in the forefront now, rather belatedly, but at least now admitting that those figures are flawed.
I asked you at the beginning, was this an issue? You seem to be saying now it's not an issue because the figures are all wrong.
I'm saying it's an issue because people and politicians make it an issue. Actually, it's not nearly as much of a problem as some people make out.
OK, David Conway, it's not nearly as much an issue as politicians pretend it is.
I think there has been a conspiracy of silence among many politicians for a very long period, and they've suddenly started to take an interest in the subject because they have woken up to the fact that so alienated have large sections of what were previously their natural supporters become as a result of the competition and the rundown in public services that they're having to share from increased numbers of immigrants, that these politicians have now begun to talk about the issue, whereas previously they were ignoring it.
The trouble with that, of course, is I fear on certain issues like immigration and penal policy, prisons, things of that nature, politicians tend to follow public opinion rather than to lead it.
What
we need to see is more leadership and less populism. What we're seeing at the moment, as we're coming towards an election, more and more politicians merely echo echoing the fears that are engendered by some right-wing parties like the BNP to actually bolster up public disquiet on the whole thing.
Yeah, but hang on a sec. Liam Byrne is a Labour immigration minister. He's not a member of a right-wing party, and even he is acknowledging that people feel unsettled by the amount of immigration. He's not inventing this issue. He cites the example in his constituency where a local school in Hodge Hill has seen an increase in the number of pupils coming in who have English as a second language in 1 year from 5% to 20%. Now, that's his reality. And he says that is, of course, putting a strain on the resources of that school because they have to devote more teaching time, more effort into helping those pupils.
Of course it does.
Therefore, is it not understandable that local people might be concerned that immigration is affecting the education of their children? So they're not inventing the issue.
There are certain areas where you need to have a proper policy to deal with sudden influxes of people. But that doesn't mean it's happening universally across the country. But I can also take you to schools in Glasgow where headmasters are crying out for more asylum-seeking children because they so elevate the standards of the school, because these children are the ones who are determined to do well and actually give everybody else in school this impetus of entrepreneurialism and desire to succeed, which frankly I'm afraid in some of our schools is lacking amongst some of the indigenous population.
And David Conway, the government has just introduced a point system for people coming into this country and clearly is seeking to tighten up on immigration controls. Do you think that is the right approach, and have they gone far enough?
They're beginning to step in the right direction, but I think until they set an annual limit so that they can start to try and control and to plan more selectively. At the moment, the point system is still not going to be able, in effect, to set limits.
What do you think the limit should be?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, we've taken in a lot of people and we need a long time to digest them and to integrate them. The country has had a wonderful ability in the past to do that. I'm not against emigration, I'm not against immigration, but zero net immigration for the foreseeable future.
David Conway and Keith Best. You're listening to Politics UK on the BBC's World Service with me, Norman Smith. Britain's chief finance minister, Gordon Brown, has won an enviable reputation as the Iron Chancellor. He's routinely described, even by political opponents, as the best chancellor since the war. And certainly, compared to the disaster-prone record of some of his Labour predecessors, he has an impressive record. Unemployment, inflation, interest rates, all have reached record lows under the brooding presence of Mr. Brown. But now, just as he seems poised to take over from Tony Blair, everything seems to be going wrong. First, there have been a series of embarrassing attacks on his character by some of his former colleagues, including the former top civil servant, Mr. Blair's cabinet secretary, Lord Turnbull, who described Mr. Brown as Stalinist. Worse, from Mr. Brown's perspective, even the economy seems to have turned against him. Inflation has crept up above his self-imposed ceiling of 3%, mortgages have hit a 10-year high, and unemployment is beginning to rise again. No wonder, then, that the Conservatives this week tabled a motion of no confidence in the Chancellor. It failed lamentably, but it's clear a concerted effort is underway by the opposition to undermine the reputation of the Chancellor, with the Tory leader David Cameron taunting the Prime Minister in the Commons over why he wouldn't publicly back Mr. Brown as his successor.
The interesting thing, Mr. Speaker, he will not endorse the Chancellor. Now, on this side of the House, we know why we don't want the Chancellor. He's complicated the tax system, virtually bankrupted the pension system. He's impossible to work with. He never says sorry. That's why we don't want the Chancellor. What do you think's wrong with him?
Let me tell him what's right with him.
And the Prime Minister then duly reeled off a list of Mr. Brown's achievements, coupled with a sharp dig at David Cameron's role as a former adviser to the Conservative Chancellor Norman Lamont back in 1992 during what became known as Black Wednesday, when interest rates hit 15%.
This is the Chancellor that's delivered the strongest economic growth this country's ever seen. Interest rates half the levels of the previous Conservative government. The highest ever employment. The lowest unemployment for years, rising living standards, and what's he delivered for the British economy? A bit part on Black Wednesday.
But should Mr. Brown be worried? Is it all going wrong for him? And is his hard-won reputation for economic prudence crumbling before his eyes, just as he hopes to step inside number 10? To consider this, I brought together Brooks Newmark, a Conservative member of the Treasury Select Committee, Julia Goldsworthy, economic spokeswoman for the Liberal Democrats, and Geoffrey Robinson, a former Treasury minister and close friend of Gordon Brown. I began by asking Brooks Newmark if he thought the Chancellor's record for economic competence was beginning to unravel.
Well, I think the chickens are coming home to roost, and we take two issues that came out this week. One was the inflation figure, which there's a target of 2%, and we're now 50% over that target. We're at 3.1%. And we also have another indicator, that's CPI. The other indicator is RPI. And the retail price index is now at a 16-year high of 4.8%. And I think those are beginning to shake the Chancellor's credibility. The other one is with pensions, a decision he made 10 years ago. We found out that he was given advice, actually not necessary, to pursue the decision to get rid of dividend tax credits, which has cost pensioners £100 billion. And I think those two issues, I think, are beginning to shake confidence in the Chancellor.
Geoffrey Robinson, you have worked with the Chancellor, you're a friend of the Chancellor. Don't you sense that just as he's seeking to take over, everything seems to be going pear-shaped for him?
I think we have an economic situation now and an economic record over the last 10 years that probably to some extent is the envy of our friends in Europe and in North America. If you look at the sustained growth in the economy, stability in the economy, the level of employment in the economy, the investment in our public services that has taken place, I think it is a remarkable record. Now we have a blip. I think it is just that. In inflation, there's been the double hit of successive oil price increases, the second one of which wasn't anticipated. The governor is very confident that with increase in interest rates and the fantastic innovation of making the bank independent helped in this situation, that we should get back on track there. So no, I think it's a good situation now and an excellent record.
But as you know, we, the electorate, are an ungrateful lot. We don't really care what he's done in the past. We just look around now and we see interest rates, our mortgages having to go up again. We see inflation going up. We see question marks about our pension. We see unemployment going up. Don't you have the sense that actually things are just turning the wrong way for him now?
Let's look forward. If we were looking at a period where we could see no growth, or we could see really a rise in unemployment, which I don't think we're going to look at, I might be tended to agree with you. Fact is, we're looking at sustained growth, it's sustained increases in employment, and rising living standards. I don't think that's a bad prospect.
Julie Goldsworthy, do you think people are perhaps beginning to revise their views about the Chancellor and the economy?
I think people are genuinely beginning to feel that the Chancellor's grip is slipping. If you cast your mind back to the budget just a few weeks ago, you know, if you believed everything that the Chancellor said, you'd think that the UK was some nirvana of economic stability. You know, we haven't seen stability like this since records began. But the reality is this week we've seen inflation going up, which means mortgages going up for most people, because it's probably going to mean a rise in interest rates. And I think that for a lot of people, they will have felt that his kind of rabbit out of the hat at the budget of announcing personal tax cuts for the standard rate of income tax, but learning that that's actually going to be achieved by increasing taxes for those on lower incomes, you know, that's going to backfire. And I think people are beginning to feel that maybe his control is slipping slightly and his credibility is just slowly being undermined around the edges.
Brooks Newmark, isn't there a suspicion, though, that this really isn't anything to do with economics and it's everything to do with politics and an attempt by the Conservative Party basically to rubbish the character of the Chancellor? That's what this is about.
Well, we don't need the Conservative Party to rubbish Gordon Brown's character. He does it himself with his rather aggressive, brutal style of debating. But let's look at the facts. The facts are that inflation is at a 16-year high.
Yeah, but you name for me one Conservative Chancellor who has a better record.
I can say both. I would definitely say Ken Clark.
Kenneth Clark. A million unemployed.
With Kenneth Clark, the direction which, from when he took over as Chancellor, left, in fact, Gordon Brown with a very strong legacy with which to move forward on. But let's turn to child poverty. Child poverty, one of the big things that Gordon Brown was trying to push to reduce, child poverty is now up by 100,000 children. Now, that is not good. Productivity, Geoffrey Robbins talked about productivity, but productivity growth is the worst it's been since the early 60s.
Okay.
So the facts actually speak differently.
I think people do have a view of what they think Gordon Brown is like as a person, but I do have to say that I do find some of the personal attacks very distasteful and almost childish. My mind is cast back to a time a few Treasury questions ago when the Conservative Shadow Chancellor, I think, made a commentary on having Gordon Brown's handwriting analysed and the kind of insight that gave on his personality. You know, this is Punch and Judy politics of the lowest order.
Yes, but which to be does fair, there are serious figures who've made, you know, pretty damning comments, like the former cabinet secretary, Lord Turnbull, who said he was a Stalinist in the way he dealt with things. I mean, you know, you can't dismiss that as a bit of political Punch and Judy.
No, and those perhaps are more meaningful insights than some of the rubbish that gets thrown around in the chamber of the House of Commons. But ultimately, the Chancellor does have to be judged on his record. And I think that where the Conservatives are going wrong is by going all out on the attack. You know, there has to be some credit given, but you also have to judge him on his record, on the facts. We are seeing inflation rising, unemployment is on the move upwards again, and we're seeing an issue of huge amounts of personal debt, you know, an issue that Gordon Brown hasn't even come close to recognising, let alone tackling.
Geoffrey Robinson, I just want to finish with a last thought with you. We had the Chancellor the other day saying that the era of celebrity was passing and apparently we're all joining book clubs and that sort of thing. Whatever his economic record, doesn't that kind of underlie the sort of the weakness of the Chancellor? He is, for whatever reason, not a very appealing, charismatic person. He's not a great communicator, and that is a real weakness for him if he wants to become Prime Minister.
Well, everybody's saying this, and I can understand people pushing it around who want to ensure that that perception is reinforced and increased. All I can say is that you tried being Chancellor for 10 years and Shadow Chancellor before that to the Labour Party in opposition for 5 years. That's 15 years. You come out of it with the success he has in economic terms on the one hand, and with your character as intact and sane and balanced as it is personal terms on the other hand, and you'll not have done badly. What I say to everybody is, don't listen to all this self-interested and hypocritical cant of his opponents and those that fear him. Just judge the man when he's free of the burdens of the Treasury, whose principal role, as we all know quite genuinely, has to be to say no. And when he's freed of that burden and those shackles, let's judge the man when we see the whole man as Prime Minister in Number 10.
Geoffrey Robinson, Julia Goldsworthy and Brooks Newmark. The former Prime Minister, John Major, famously said he wanted to create a classless society. His successor, Tony Blair, too, has often boasted of Britain being a more equal, less class-obsessed country. If anything, the British these days all regard themselves as middle class. Even the Deputy Prime Minister, John Prescott, a man once happy to describe himself as working class, now says he's middle class. But this week, a rather different picture emerged of a country apparently still gripped by class divisions, following the breakup of the romance between Prince William, the future King of England, and his girlfriend Kate Middleton. While nobody really knows why the pair parted, there's been much talk in the press that, according to Prince William's friends, she was just too middle class to marry into the royal family. And the same friends seem to have mocked Miss Middleton's mother, a former air hostess, for using allegedly common expressions like pleased to meet you when she met the Queen, and other social gaffes such as saying pardon or toilet instead of lavatory. And while there may be nothing in such talk, the fact that all Britain's newspapers have devoted pages and pages of comment and analysis to discussing questions of social behaviour among the upper classes has led some to suggest that Britain is just as riven by class-bound snobbery as ever. But are we? Well, I discussed this question with two foreign observers, Mary Jordan of the Washington Post, Agnès Poirier of the French periodical Télérama, and Jan Moyer of the Daily Telegraph. Mary Jordan first.
What's really going on in the minds of those two young people, we may never know. But the comments about it, that her mother, because she chewed gum or addressed the Queen in the wrong way, may have botched this fabulous relationship, is so telling. And I think, you know, when I talk to people that I think here there is still a strong aristocracy and strong class divisions and they deny it, here is more evidence that, hello, it hasn't gone away.
Agnes, you've lived in Britain for more than 10 years now. Do you think we're a class-obsessed society?
Well, yes, I do. You know, when I arrived in the UK, I finally understood the term class. I don't want to say that France is a classless society, although, you know, I would be tempted to say that. But it's like, you know, I obviously shared flats, and I discovered that there were three ways of naming the same object, like sofa, settee, couch. And my middle-class flatmate instructed me how to say, you know, living room or drawing room and things like this. And suddenly I was not only learning one language, but three at once.
Jan, are we as bad as all that?
Yes, I think we are. I think it's at every level of society and it covers everything. I mean, we like to think that we live in a classless society, but you can't even buy coloured loo roll and you can't call it toilet paper. I mean, it starts in the bathroom, it goes through every room in the house. It affects everything you wear, the foods you eat. If anything, it's become more and more subtle over recent years. But yes, I think we're all hung up on class at a level perhaps that's deeper than ever before.
But doesn't the whole saga between Kate Middleton and Prince William, doesn't that actually tell us more about the royal family and those around William and his snobbishness than British attitudes towards class?
Well, I don't think the Queen or any of the senior royals would seriously be bothered with any of this stuff. I mean, apparently it's been a lot of William's friends or associates or hangers-on or whoever they are who've been seeing all this stuff. And, I mean, I tend to think it's a bit like, you know, a gang of boys who've suddenly got the King boy back in the fold again because they got rid of that pesky, soppy girl and have been sort of declaiming about the family because of that. I mean, does it still matter if people say, how do you do, instead of pleased to meet you? Apparently, in certain sections of society, it does.
But Mary, when you go around Britain, do you find people are actually concerned about whether you say toilet or lavatory?
I think what bothers me a bit more is that, you know, in the United States, even no matter what your education or how much land and if you have no castles, if you succeed at something, if you're a great basketball player or you make a lot of money, even if it's selling ice cream, you're a success. But here, if you have a lot of money, it's not necessarily enough among a certain crowd. You have to have breeding, you have to have family, you have to have history. And I think that's where it's very different here than it is certainly in the United States.
Agnes, surely most of us nowadays, though, would describe ourselves quite comfortably as middle class.
Yes, but there are different... I remember being told that you had the lower middle class and the upper middle class. And there are different sections of society. And I noticed that among the upper middle class, there was an incredible boundless admiration for anything aristocrat, you know, for, I don't know, wearing Wellington boots and going to very cold manors at the weekend and just walking in the countryside and things like this. And was in France, the aristocracy is totally ridiculed. I mean, we don't have many of them left because we killed them all. But you know, an aristocrat is a buffoon by definition, whereas here it's somebody you look up to.
But Jan, do we really look up to the aristocracy? Because I'm thinking about the reaction to the Kate Middleton-Prince William split. If you read the mainstream papers, if you listen to the phone-ins, most of them seem to be backing Kate Middleton and her mum pretty strongly.
Yes, I mean, they seem like nice, decent people, and they certainly don't deserve the fallout from this sort of toxic brush they seem to have had with the royal family. People say that they do hate the aristocracy, but, you know, the point is that there are lots of people who do secretly quite like them or would quite like to ape them, or if they wouldn't ever admit to that, they're certainly very interested in all these sort of secret signals. I mean, one of the things that came out this week that was a new one on me, that apparently it's a common thing to have chunky marmalade on your breakfast table, but it's very, very posh to have runny marmalade. I mean, there are other things, like apparently yellow Labradors are common, but black ones aren't. I mean, it is a social minefield, and you have to be very careful what you do and what you eat. Sushi, for example, a prominent socialite told me the other week, is a common thing to eat. You shouldn't be having that.
Mary, I would have thought, though, we're all becoming more sort of homogenous. We all shop at Tesco, we all buy our furniture at IKEA, we all gawp at Big Brother. I mean, we seem to be doing the same things the whole time.
I think that the aristocracy is shrinking, but they're still there. They still have their very posh clubs, they're very exclusive. And this idea, again, that just because you inherited a title, a land name, that somehow you're somebody, while it sickens people in the States and other places, here, for some reason, it's still a vaunted thing. I've just written reams about it because the Queen is going to the States and there's utter fascination. I mean, she's the headline act because she's coming over and she's for the 400th anniversary of Jamestown. So while we kind of disdain a monarchy and all kind of hereditary positions in life, we're fascinated that England holds on to it. We also love to hear what was going on with Kate Wills and who he's going to go out with next. But anyway, the idea that in the States, it's the fairy tale is if you are poor or middle class and you somehow get the dashing prince who's rich. And here the idea that you have to be rich to marry rich is kind of what's bothering people.
One of the other striking things I suppose many people will look at in terms of class is if you look at our politicians. It is striking, for example, if you look at the modern Conservative Party, they're actually led now by an old Etonian who seems to surround himself with people who are at schools like him. I mean, does that reinforce the view that we are, by and large, still a class-ridden society?
Well, in the elections in 1990, John Major promised to make Britain a classless society by the 21st century. And, of course, that hasn't happened. I mean, if anything, we're further away from that sort of utopia than ever before. I mean, as you said, the Tory front bench is stuffed with old Etonians. Most of the leading Labour politicians all went to public schools as well. So that would seem to suggest that the classless society is further away than ever before.
Agnes, if you're right then we are a class-ridden society, why is that? Is that because we didn't have our own revolution and get rid of them all?
Well, I think so, yes. So it's high time you did it.
Agnes Poirier, Mary Jordan and Jan Moyer. And from a class-free, super-egalitarian edition of Politics UK, that's all for this week. We'll be back at the same time next week. Until then, ta-ta. Or should I say, goodbye.
That was Norman Smith.